we don't want to be too high for too long in a falling interest rate environment. And so we're really focused on what are those costs today? What is the projections? Where are the pricing models? And how do we make sure that we're giving as much back to our members through that pricing, also making sure that we're making sound financial decisions with credit unions, and at the same time, growing deposits in order to grow.
Welcome to 22 Minutes in Lending, your go-to podcast for insights on all things lending. From lending practices, regulatory updates, how to enhance lending efforts, and more. In each episode, Vince Passione connects with industry leaders to discuss the latest trends and happenings around the lending industry. Let's dive into the latest in lending.
Welcome to this special multi-episode series on 22 Minutes in Lending. I'm your host, Vince Passione, and I'm pleased to welcome three credit union leaders helping shape financial services in their communities for this panel discussion. Joining us are Dee Eady, the president and CEO of Pine Bluff Cotton Belt FCU in Pine Bluff, Arkansas. Tanya Romero Sturgeon, the president and CEO of Guadalupe CU in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And Tyler Valentine, the president and CEO of StagePoint FCU in Laramie, Wyoming. Together, they're going to share their experiences, strategies, and visions for the future, offering what I believe to be a very unique glimpse into smaller credit unions and the critical role that they play in fostering financial well-being in their communities. Welcome, everyone, and thank you for joining us today.
Hi, pleased to be here. Glad to be here.
So it's been a pretty turbulent 18 months, and we've seen some serious economic headwinds. We had record inflation, we had record federal rate hikes, and credit unions ended 2023 at an 86.5 loan-to-share ratio, creating some serious liquidity concerns, both for the CEOs and I'm sure your board. So let's start with you first, Tanya. So you assumed the role of CEO in October last year. You've been at Guadalupe for about 20 years. On your role as CEO, you kind of looked ahead when you're at COO working on the transition plan. So what did you do to get prepared for this kind of economic uncertainty and what we saw unfold last year?
We had some great succession planning with my predecessor, Winona Nava. We worked for a very long time. Even prior to knowing her retirement, she worked with our full management team to provide us education during planning session, during management meetings, any opportunity we had to learn what was going on in our economy. And we would have lots of collaborative discussions about what does that mean for our credit union. And we just always make sure that we keep in mind, you know, who we are, who we're here to serve, you know, making sure that our mission and vision guide us in our decisioning and how we implement products and services and any strategy that we do. And so during our succession planning, Winona really made sure that I understood all of those processes, you know, which I was very grateful for, that really intense training that we had for so long prior to her retirement.
Well, great. Let's move to Tyler. So Tyler, you took on your first CEO role in 2008. So were there any lessons that you learned during your tenure that prepared you for what happened in the last 18 months?
Yeah, and I think there's a lot that goes into this when it comes to the lessons learned from 2008 and then the pandemic. And I think we're going through once in a generation financial crisis every 2 to 3 years is kind of how it feels like since I became CEO. And I think every time we have one of these events, it's really about learning from that situation and what do you take forward. I think what we've really drilled down on is really being there for our members, making sure we have all of the options, really coaching our desk solutions team to make sure that they're offering those options and those people that are responding to us and talking to us, that we're putting everything on the table and making sure that we can get people through these crises at different moments. On the underwriting side, it's a little bit different too. What we don't want to do is pull back too far just because the economy has turned or isn't as good, because then you're disenfranchising those people that might be shopping or looking during that period of time. And it also affects our community through our business partners. So we do a lot of indirect lending. We have a lot of really deep relationships with our dealers. And if we step away from doing some of those loans during those downtimes, that's less vehicles that are sold. It's less income in our community. It's less upward mobility. Maybe those people that are buying those need those cars to get to work. So it's really important to us that we're not reactionary, that we're really strategic. What we had done before, we continue to do. Maybe there's tweaks on it. Maybe we soften something or reimagine it differently, but that we don't just step away from product line that could adversely impact our community and our members and those potential members through that indirect channel.
So Tyler, was there any point in time during the last 18 months when you, like, for example, indirect auto, pretty difficult product at a time like this, and especially when you look at things like, well, there was a loan to value and you look at residual values, right, of some of these used vehicles, especially where I think prior to the pandemic and during the pandemic, you probably saw like a 42% increase in the cost of a used vehicle. Your thoughts around that when you were just continuing to forge ahead, that's going to be difficult to do when you're thinking about how that might affect your ability if you have to repossess these vehicles or.
Yeah, and we have seen those used vehicle prices come down about half the amount that they appreciated, right? So they're down about 21% over where we were. And so we are seeing it as we have collections and charge-offs and things like that. But we knew that was going to happen. We could see it, right? I mean, you can't have record levels of appreciation happen and not have some level of understanding that's temporary and that it's going to come down. So what we tried to do was just be really judicious in how we underwrote those loans that, you know, maybe if we would normally be 130% loan value on an A-plus borrower, we're backing some of that down. We're maybe not being as aggressive on loan to value when it comes to our non-prime lending. So it's massaging it to match the situation, but it's not stepping completely out of the space. And it's recognizing when, you know, the camper side of it, we do a lot of recreational vehicle loans and power sport as well. And so we knew COVID campers were a thing. People were camping in our area and buying a lot of those campers. And we did a lot of financing in those campers. We knew that as those loans sat there and people maybe no longer were going camping because now they're doing their traditional family vacations, we were going to have some of those campers go bad. We priced for that up front. We knew we needed a return on those. So we were, our effective yield on that portfolio was over 7% all the way through the pandemic. So the money that we've made throughout course of these years on those loans, we knew was going to be needed if we had losses, which we experienced some of those as we've gone through 2023. People just deciding it's not what they need, inflation hitting their pocketbooks, their toys and their campers are often the first things that go. And so we've seen some of that, but we knew it would be there. We planned for it. We put money aside for it. We had a strategic initiative around how we were going to lend on that type of collateral and what the possible ramifications, the worst case scenario could be as we move through, you know, kind of the maturity or the seasoning on those loans.
So at Guadalupe Credit Union, we did see an increase of lending for recreational vehicles during COVID, although we have not yet seen a big delinquency increase on that particular product line. So we've been in a good situation so far with that. And the rise of lending on recreational vehicles has already gone back downward to a more average level for us. And so that's what we've been seeing as a result of a lot of people wanting to go camping in the rural areas during the COVID time.
This is Kara Van Wert, Chief Lending Officer at Viridian Credit Union. Since 2016, we've been working with LendKey and joined the Member Student Lending CUSO to help provide student loan solutions to our members. As the current CUSO board chair, I'm proud of the CUSO LendKey partnership, as this has allowed Viridian to help over 12,000 of our credit union members finance their education and improve their financial health. LendKey's streamlined processes simplifies the lending experience, making it easier for our members to access the financial support they need.
So Dee, Pine Bluff, very engaged, very enmeshed in your community. And when the financial institution's under stress, it has a knock-on effect in the community. So in your community, we talked about the other day, right? There's big challenges here, right? High rates of poverty, low average income. So talk to us a little bit about where Cotton Belt's been focusing to try to drive the most value in the community.
Well, what we had to do was to become a CDFI first so that we could obtain some grant money to help us in the community, because as a credit union, totally focused on who we're serving. We're in a rural area. This town used to be 60,000 people. Within about 10 years, it dropped to 30,000 people. We're quite rural around us, and that really impacts what people need. So our emphasis has been, based on the grants that we've received, is to give loans to those who can't get it anywhere else. That's really our clientele. We try to put these renters into homes. We've had many members who are in their 60s who've never owned a home. And they may buy a $50,000 house, but we've helped them with that. And it's quite amazing when you help people in that area, I think, become homeowners. There's a sense of pride that goes to them that they've never been able to have. And we're in an area where they spend a lot on vehicles, but everything else is not near as important. So I think we really had to help those with low income and poverty, but we've done it through education, working with the HUD counselor, and we're all becoming certified financial counselors in our offices. So all those things are helping because of education.
Amazing. We're going to get back to the CDFI piece in a minute. I want to just touch on liquidity. So obviously, we talked about it earlier. You know, in the fourth quarter, we saw that of 2023, most credit unions, the average loan-to-share ratio was about 86.5%. We haven't seen that in probably two decades. So we'll start with you, Tanya. Any changes in the balance sheet and funding in order to deal with liquidity constraints?
We actually had a really interesting strategy to help with liquidity issues, and it involved working with a partner. As we are also a CDFI credit union, and we were at an inclusive conference when we met a vendor named CNO. And CNO helped us to find non-member deposits that came in at our standard CD rate. And it was perfect timing for us to bring in some much needed deposit growth at low cost. And so that was a fantastic strategy that worked quite well for us.
And you said it was at your CD rates, Tanya. So what was the cost of funds for you?
Well, what they did was they brought in the money and put it into an account at like a 24-month CD. So it was a CD, and they are earning the dividends of the same interest rate that all of our members would earn. And so they weren't asking for anything special, any higher rate. What happens is they find companies that want to invest in, you know, they want to be able to say like, hey, we helped members of impoverished counties, or we helped a credit union build these products or services. You know, by bringing their deposits into our credit union, they helped us do what we do. And so they get to be a part of that. And that was kind of their cost. Our cost for bringing in their deposits was just being attached to what we do and who we serve. Yeah, so it was really great. I mean, it didn't cost us anything to bring it in, but the dividends, like I said, it's the same rate. They didn't want anything special. So it was a really great deal to bring in the funds. And we know we had to work out with them how much we were looking for. It didn't all come in at one time. It was spread out, but it worked out very perfect.
And Dee, what about you? Anything on the broker deposit side or Federal Home Loan Bank? How did you deal with liquidity?
I've been without liquidity, to be honest. And there's been some participations I would have loved to have purchased, but didn't have the money for. I've gotten over $5 million in grant money, and we've been able to put that out in loans. We also make sure that the loans are repayable, that people can afford the payment and that sort of thing. We're underwriting well, so we're keeping the money cycling, but also have a healthy line of credit with Canada. And I would lend the fund that Tanya's using, I think.
We can share contact information.
Thank you.
And Tyler, how about your credit union? What about liquidity there, and how'd you manage through it?
It's been tight, and we're really used to it. So we, pre-COVID, were running 92 to 97% loan to share ratio. So we're really used to having tight liquidity. I always tell my team, we're a credit union, we're not a savings union. Our job, the highest, best use of our members' funds is out in loans in our community to those people that need them. So we're definitely a lending institution. We focus on that. Liquidity definitely was a challenge for us this year. We did do some non-member deposits. We use a platform called Raisin that brought in non-member deposits, you know, around the country and put that money on deposit with us. It's higher cost money than, you know, what we might have in our shop, but it was needed to maintain some of the liquidity measurements that we see. We have access to more non-member deposits should we need it. We also have a line of credit with corporate credit unions and an available line of credit through the Federal Home Loan Bank. So we have a lot of liquidity sources out there. We're also a member of the CLF through NCUA. So lots of backup liquidity sources. I think what's important for us to recognize as we, and what we're really focused on from a strategy perspective around liquidity, is we have a chief lending officer, but not necessarily a chief audit officer, right? We have a chief operations officer, but her focus is much broader than the narrower scope in lending. And so we have to be as strategic on the deposit side as we are on the lending side. And I think this year, as we look at how we're going to grow deposits in order to grow loans, we're really focused on how do we price at the right point, especially with the prospect of falling interest rates. We don't want to be too high for too long in a falling interest rate environment. And so we're really focused on what are those costs today? What is the projections? Where are the pricing models? And how do we make sure that we're giving as much back to our members through that pricing, but also making sure that we're making sound financial decisions for the credit union, and at the same time, growing deposits in order to grow.
So you touched on deposits, and there's been lots of conversations in recent conferences about, you know, deposit betas and how quickly, right, credit unions had to raise rates. Probably the first time in decades that credit unions had to raise rates as rapidly as you all had to do. And there's been discussions about raising rates across all of the deposit products, that, you know, some of your clients are sticky and they don't expect the rate raise. They'd love it, but they don't expect it. We see some credit unions offer things like, hey, a checking account, but if you bring in a new deposit, we'll offer you a higher rate on that. Any of you deploying those kind of strategies?
I have tried that, no, honestly, and I think like every member has a little money sitting in their account here that they want that same rate for. And I don't want to lose our core members. So, yes, we end up giving them that higher rate. So all it's done for us is raise our cost of funds.
Right.
That happens with, you know, you bring in some new money, but most of the time in our situation, it's our current membership.
Yeah. Those direct deposit customers, they're very sticky, right?
Yes. And I appreciate that. But
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, we've had a rewards checking account for a long time. And we're looking now at adding tiers to that rewards checking account. So right now it's capped at 15,000, you know, so they earn 2% on their money if they do all things needed in order to get that 2% rate. But at 15,000, then that rate stops. And so we're looking at adding, you know, a tier or two above that in order to have people, if they're sitting on liquid money, that they're going to sit on it in their checking account with us, and that they have to do the 20 debit card transactions and have direct deposit, have home banking and have e-statements, all of those things that save us money, but also aggregating some of those balances into checking accounts, as we've seen kind of the cannibalization of some of the checking account funds that have been sitting for a long time, move into money market accounts or move into CD accounts, that it popped our cost of funds. And so if we can hold some of those funds into those core deposits, even at higher rates, the requirements that they're doing these other things also helps offset some of those costs.
So both Pine Bluff and Guadalupe are both CDFIs. So Tanya, how long ago did you become a community development financial institution? And then when you think about the benefits, right, the grants and excess capital, whether it was sub-debt or EQ2, can you talk a little bit about how the journey, the benefits to you, and how it positions you in the community?
We've been a CDFI. I would say we've been a CDFI longer than we have the designation. We didn't know we were operating as a CDFI. Our previous CEO had met with someone from Inclusive who was like learning about our credit union and said, you know, hey, you guys are already a CDFI. And so he encouraged us to apply for that and a certification. And we did 15-ish years ago. And so it has helped us really. It has opened the doors to a lot of grant funding. With the CDF grant in that time frame, we've received a little over $7.7 million in grant funds that we're able to turn back into our community in terms of lending funds. And so it's been a really great journey. It helps open the doors to more products and services that might be, you know, we could take on a little more risk than we might otherwise because we have this grant that it can be applied towards loan loss reserves, for example. So it helps you to want to take on more risk and more types of borrowers. You know, we can do more programs with it. We've been able to bring in more staff. Dee was talking about certified financial counselors, which we also have. We do have 7 of them dedicate, like that's their full role versus hybrid. Like I open accounts and I also coach you, you know. So we've been able to do all of these things, these creative products and services, take on more risk and have this department thanks to these grant funds that we've received with this certification.
No, that's great. And Dee, how long ago did you become a CDFI? And talk a little bit about the way you use the funds and whether or not you were able to access additional capital.
We became a CDFI about 5 years ago now. And the first grant opportunity we actually passed on, second, because we had just received a large one. We didn't feel we could manage it well. So we kind of pick and choose based on if it's a fit for us. We're using a lot of the money, not only for lending, but secondly, for new digital products, for instance, different things that we need to be able to advance the credit union, we can get the money from a financial assistance grant. And so that has helped us tremendously. The credit union, when I came here, was not advanced on any of those things. And so what we've done is try to get in to the century we're living in, to put it that way, I guess, and add those products that people want. So we're heavy into all these projects.
Sorry to jump in. I just had a question for either or both around CDFI and the uncertainty that exists, the continued funding, because I'm not CDFI. We're low income designated, but not CDFI. What are your thoughts around that? And are you worried that that could one day no longer be there to offer these products and services to your membership?
I'm expecting that, in all honesty. All it's going to take is an administrative change, and I think that will happen. In the meantime, I've been able to get a lot of people in homes that wouldn't have had that opportunity otherwise, and that's the kind of thing, the kind of lending we've always done. Like Tanya said, that, you know, they've already been a community credit union. This just gives them additional funds to do so. And so I'm just capitalizing on the administration we've got up there now, but I fully expect that mine could change and be very different. The previous administration was not this generous. So that's what I expect again.
I believe the CDFI certifications have this sort of a pause, right? Is that right?
They did. We've all had to recertify. We're working on recertifications as we speak.
Yeah, some of the rules for how you get certified are being amended, or some of the rules that they were wanting to implement didn't go through yet, but like a little more tight process to in terms of qualifying someone as a CDFI. So I guess I would say it's probably good intention, but it's been a process.
So that wraps our first episode in our series with Dee, Tanya, and Tyler. Stay tuned to hear more about challenges small credit unions are facing in part 2. Thank you to everyone for tuning in, and remember to hit the subscribe button so you don't miss the next episode in this series. I'll meet you right here back at the continuation of this special 22 Minutes in Lending panel discussion.